listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Spylandia by Adam Sierowski, with photographs by Brian Fink. Next photos, watch party. The Sandbar Sports Grill in Cocoa Beach, roughly a dozen miles from Cape Canaveral's Space Launch Complex 40. And stay-at-home mom and Florida-based amateur sleuth Christina Dowd. The woman remained undercover. I'll call her Sarah Russo. Her message, the Chinese and the Russians are eating our lunch. Daily. At first, Cute wasn't convinced. I was like, there's no way this is happening. I couldn't even spell CI before I met her. Russo persisted. She got our attention by drilling home that there was an existential threat here in Central Florida and that we're under attack by foreign adversaries. Cute took her concerns to Matt Butler, a former SWAT colleague who had risen to become CFIX's director. It's easy to hide in plain sight here, Butler told me. Chinese nationals, Russian nationals, people from everywhere. You don't see that in South Dakota. You see it in Orlando, Titusville, the Space Coast. Law enforcement runs in Butler's blood. He followed his father and brother into the Orange County Sheriff's Office, working narcotics, then SWAT, then intelligence. When Butler was asked to take over CFIX, Russo's warnings landed hard. She was telling us, there's a lot we can't say, but collection is happening, and ringing the bell at the Bureau is getting tiresome. CFIX had strong relationships with FBI field offices across Florida, but Butler and many experts I canvassed essentially described the Bureau's resident agency in Brevard County, the heart of the Space Coast, as the single point of failure. According to Butler and several colleagues, the top agent there dismissed Russo as an alarmist and invoked no drog, DROG, CI shorthand for the absence of derogatory information. Such a designation, evidently, would save agents from wasting time chasing phantoms. This mission, Butler said, belongs to the Bureau. We weren't about to piss in their lane, but I thought maybe we could rattle the cage long enough that they'd start paying attention. CFIX began discreetly mapping the threat. Cute's team, using police dispatch databases, pulled reports of suspicious persons, vehicles, incidents. What emerged was hard to ignore. Officers were being sent time and again to sensitive national security locations, only to discover non-Americans whose presence raised more questions than answers. These weren't misunderstandings. Individuals of Chinese descent were flying drones over restricted sites. They were peering through windows. They were slipping into trees to aim listening devices at defense contractors. They were trying to breach off-limits areas by posing as delivery drivers. The activity wasn't confined to the Chinese. An immaculately groomed Russian family, straight out of the Americans, appeared at SpaceX's Cape Canaveral complex, presenting themselves as tourists. CFIX later learned the same family had surfaced at a SpaceX facility in California under the guise of sightseeing. Nor was that an isolated episode. Butler recalled a text from an off-duty deputy at a defense trade show at the Orange County Convention Center. "There's a Russian woman here," the deputy wrote. "She's rubbing up on admirals and generals, tracking them, asking questions." Butler dispatched plainclothes officers from the county sheriff's intelligence unit to observe. The woman was polished, credentialed as a vendor, and unusually attentive to the brass. To Butler's mind, it did not resemble networking. CFIX ran her through its systems. The picture soon resolved. Russian citizen, clean cover. A report was written. The handoff was made. We gave it to the FBI, Butler said. Never heard another word. The same held true, security officials told me, when CFIX forwarded a photo of the woman from the sandbar. It went into a black hole. In 2023, Butler convened a closed-door meeting of what he called the Five Families, CFIX's public and private sector partners, to coordinate a response to what his team saw as a rapidly metastasizing CI threat. The session barely got off the ground. According to Butler, an account corroborated by two others in the room, the Bureau's man in Brevard, also in attendance, cut in early. One, there is no collection happening in our area of responsibility, he said, and two, even if it were, you wouldn't recognize it. Butler knew a diss when he heard one. He said he told the G-man, point blank, which TV show did you just step off of? Because that was textbook FBI typecasting. The FBI agent's purported rebuke ran counter to the message coming out of Washington at the time. Then FBI Director Christopher Wray was stating publicly that the Bureau was opening new China-related counterintelligence cases at a breakneck pace, roughly one every 10 hours, and that nearly half of its active CI docket involved China. Surely such incursions were occurring up and down the Space Coast, too. Nearly 3 years later, things have only ramped up. Just weeks ago, authorities in Nevada searched a residence owned by a Chinese national, Jiabezhu, which the FBI contends may have been an illegal biolab storing potentially dangerous pathogens. Police discovered cold storage units stocked with suspicious vials and containers. The same homeowner, according to law enforcement, may be connected to another property in California where detectives in 2022 found a cache of hundreds of samples marked HIV, TB, malaria, COVID, and Ebola, as well as thousands of lab mice. Zhu's attorney has insisted his client is not involved in any kind of biolab. Chilling, to say the least. And other activities have raised further concern. When asked last year to identify the most significant domestic counterintelligence threat, Wray's successor, FBI Director Kash Patel, answered without hesitation, the PRC. The Chinese Communist Party engages in the greatest level of espionage against the United States of America. Particularly troubling is how they acquire lands and real estate in and around military bases. Indeed, Chinese-linked investors hold roughly 277,000 acres of American agricultural land, as evidenced by USDA Farm Service Agency reporting. That amount sounds negligible until you plot it out. Chinese firms or individuals hold parcels across 30 states, some properties close enough to sensitive infrastructure and military sites to revive a hard truth of modern espionage, that farmland can double as a listening post, a supply chain tripwire, a hidden perch from which to watch. For years, lawmakers warned this wasn't just an economic story, but a matter of national security. Only recently did Washington shift from alarm to action. In July, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins unveiled USDA's National Farm Security Action Plan, pledging tougher limits on purchases by foreign adversaries, tighter disclosure, and potential moves to block or claw back high-risk land sales under the banner of farm security as homeland security. The house looked wrong. Everything, from the squat, one-story structure to the station wagon parked outside, had been coated in the same uneven layer of white paint, as if someone had tried hurriedly to erase it from the landscape. Along the perimeter sat a series of bulky equipment boxes, also painted white, with cords snaking back towards the building. To a casual passerby, it might have registered as a Florida eccentricity. To Christina Dowd, standing across the street that afternoon, it looked like a data center masquerading as a rental property. Dowd is not a spy. She's never worked in intelligence, carried a badge, or been taught tradecraft. She's out of her depth, but she senses when something doesn't track. A military brat, she'd grown up devouring her father's collection of spy novels. "Tom Clancy lit my brain on fire," she told me, laughing. For security reasons, she asked that I use a pseudonym. After a divorce, a remarriage, and her youngest child headed off to preschool, Dowd decided she wanted in, if only experimentally, on the shadow world she'd read about as a teenager. Any foray into counter-espionage, she conceded, would have to be freelance and local. This posed no obstacle, though. She knew that the Space Coast drew tech and talent, and the spies who trailed them. "I'm a stay-at-home mom," she said, as we sat around a fire pit on a cool December night, and I was like, "Let's test it here, just for funsies." Dowd began with something tangible, real estate. Near critical infrastructure, anomalies have a way of outing themselves, and a modest building along Highway A1A soon did just that. Bought with cash, out from under another buyer with money already in escrow, the property had changed hands for more than $1 million, a 300-fold jump from its sale price just a year earlier. It was then handed over to a property manager and leased as a residence for $6,000 a month, well beyond the reach of most locals. Then again, in real estate, location is everything. "It's just down the street from Patrick Space Force Base," Dowd said, exhaling. There were all these little red flags, and I was like, okay, what do I do with this? What she did was find a babysitter and drive back. Between school pickups and bedtime routines, Dowd began working the problem. With off-the-shelf tools, she clocked excessive Bluetooth emissions. Too dense, she said, for a 3,000-square-foot structure. "That's when I turned on a VPN," Dowd told me, referring to an encrypted connection to hide her sleuthing. "I started digging into everything I could find on these two guys, the Chinese buyer and property manager." The trail led northwest to a red-walled compound south of Orlando, emblazoned with Chinese writing and apparent in satellite imagery and property records, housing two large residences, greenhouses, a pond, and she said a small broadcast facility labeled Florida Chinese TV. When I asked Dowd what she thought she'd uncovered, she didn't hedge. "An intelligence-gathering syndicate," she said. "It didn't seem kosher, and I felt like someone who knew how to do this properly should probably take a look." She phoned the FBI. The call did not go well. Dowd claimed she reached the Tampa field office last April and began laying out what she'd found, the cash purchase, the proximity to a Space Force base, and so on. She said she hadn't gotten far before the intake agent cut her off. The tone, Dowd recalled, was accusatory. She was told she was engaging in racial profiling, and the line, she said, soon went dead. "That was a defining moment for me," she explained. "I had to decide whether I was just some paranoid civilian or whether I'd actually stumbled onto something real." She called back. This time, she asked for a supervisor and led with disclaimers rather than conclusions. "I'm a military spouse," she told him. "I promise I'm not an idiot. I just need 5 minutes of your time." There was a pause, she recalled, and then, "Okay, you've got five." Shortly thereafter, Dowd found herself inside the FBI's resident agency in Brevard County, where she was debriefed by a special agent. The focus, Dowd said, was narrow, the property manager and the suspicious residences. The agent asked questions, took notes. The tenor, as Dowd put it, was curious but careful. When the meeting ended, the agent supposedly said firmly but politely, "We'll take it from here." Dowd never heard back. Undeterred, she kept digging. Last November, through a mutual acquaintance, she met Michelle Rigby Assad, the former CIA officer who'd spent years separating real threats from imaginary ones. Over coffee, Dowd laid out her story. The house, the emissions, the compound, the calls to the FBI. Rigby Assad listened. "I walked away thinking two things," the ex-spy told me later. "Either she's crazy, or was on to a potential Chinese espionage operation." What struck Rigby Assad wasn't the amateurism of the inquiry, but its internal logic. "This is what counterintelligence actually looks like," she said. "Someone notices something that doesn't quite fit, and instead of explaining it away, they start pulling on the thread." She added emphatically, "People who don't want to find something rarely do." Next photos, rocket science. A satellite image of Cape Canaveral. A map of NASA's land acquisition on the Cape. The Assads on assignment in Baghdad. The Space Launch System rocket and Orion spacecraft set to launch Artemis II around the moon. On the Space Coast, there is no shortage of threads. What is less clear is who will pull them. That came into stark relief on March 14, 2025, when Joseph Assad drove me out to Kennedy Space Center to watch a manned SpaceX flight, Crew 10, climb skyward, bound for the International Space Station. The launch, originally scheduled for the 12th, had already been scrubbed once, undone by a hydraulic glitch. What spectators didn't see was that the previous day, March 13th, another problem, never publicly disclosed, had set off alarms of a different kind. According to a Florida-based counterintelligence source, a Chinese-made unmanned aerial vehicle breached restricted airspace shortly after noon. It lingered above the spaceport, flying roughly four times higher than is legally permitted by the FAA for recreational drones. Our conclusion, the source told me, was that it came from a vessel offshore. We watched the drone take off at sea and land at sea. We photographed the vessel, but we couldn't get an interdiction team to it before it bugged out. The close encounter wasn't an anomaly. Less than 2 months earlier, the feds had arrested a 71-year-old man named Zhao Guangpan for flying a drone on three separate occasions over Cape Canaveral Space Force Station and other sensitive installations. Pan captured 243 photographs and 13 videos of payload processing facilities, munitions bunkers, security checkpoints, mission control centers, fuel and ordnance storage sites, and the nuclear submarine wharf. After pleading guilty in July, he received 12 months probation, was deported to Canada, and barred from reentering the states without prior approval. An oddly forgiving sentence for conduct that bore the hallmarks of intelligence collection. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Florida declined multiple requests for comment. A seasoned FBI counterintelligence expert urged me to focus less on Pan himself than on the pattern. China's using drones of every type to gather whatever it can. Then he referred to the famous incident in February 2023 when U.S. planes shot down a mysterious unmanned craft that crossed over North American airspace. They sent the weather balloon, or whatever the hell they were calling it, over the country, no doubt about it. Threats, of course, don't always arrive by air. In November 2022, as NASA prepared for its maiden Artemis launch, agents from its Office of Protective Services made an unsettling discovery whose details have never been previously revealed. Concealed on a patch of Playa Linda Beach, well inside the security perimeter surrounding Launch Complex 39B, was a man in a wetsuit. Artemis by then was already troubled. Largely built by Boeing and Northrop Grumman, and reliant in part on refurbished space shuttle components, the program was 6 years behind schedule, $6 billion over budget, and ill-equipped to absorb another incident that would invite scrutiny. None of that diminished its appeal to America's enemies. The intruder, a 34-year-old whom officials identified to me, had not wandered ashore by accident. According to multiple sources who spoke on background, reluctant, they said, to anger colleagues who they claimed later tried to classify the episode, he surfaced in frogman gear, carrying rations, a solar charger, and other specialized equipment. The working assessment shared among these sources was that he had likely intended to remain in place for an extended period to collect instrumentation signals intelligence on Artemis. NASA turned him over to Homeland Security investigations. He had identification on him. One source with direct knowledge told me he was a Chinese national. After a brief interrogation, he was removed from the country. Drones overhead, a man inside the perimeter, a vessel just offshore. Each episode was handled promptly, quietly, in isolation. Not because it went unnoticed, but because no one had been forced to own what it meant. Far be it from Butler or Cute to know why some federal officials have seemed reluctant to prioritize the prosecution of these bad actors, or why government agencies aren't publicizing what they see as a threat to national security. One intelligence veteran who has some possible answers is Nicholas Eftemiades, a professor 1,000 miles away at Penn State Harrisburg. He's among America's most seasoned experts on Chinese espionage, having spent decades at the CIA, DIA, and State Department dissecting Beijing's intelligence apparatus. Part of the issue is sheer workload. The FBI, according to Eftemiades, has thousands of such cases in arrears. This backlog underscores Patel's assertion about the accelerating threat. Eftemiades also believes that the FBI's decades-old structure of methodically amassing information can work to its disadvantage. His view in a nutshell: you give them everything, they give you nothing. Intelligence agencies take on the structure of their adversaries. They become secretive. Whatever the case, there have been some significant, if sporadic, breakthroughs. A suspicious character in the Palmettos with a wetsuit and flippers, said Matt Butler. Come on, it was like something out of Goldfinger. That was the coup de grace. According to Butler and colleagues, after repeated run-ins and what felt like an inconsistent federal response, Butler's CFIX team decided it was time to head to Tallahassee. They brought along Sarah Russo from the CIA, as Butler recounted, to let state officials know what was happening. In Florida's capital, there was little stomach for persistent deep state reticence, or for the suggestion that Chinese intelligence operatives were roaming near sensitive sites with impunity. The group found an ally in Mark Glass, a square-jawed former Army Black Hawk helicopter pilot whom Governor Ron DeSantis had tapped to run Florida's Department of Law Enforcement, or FDLE, overseeing intelligence coordination and counterterrorism. CFIX's most pressing request was for help in getting the state legislature to change laws pertaining to security incursions and breaches. In Florida, trespassing on a construction site is a felony. Trespassing on critical infrastructure, however, was almost always a misdemeanor. The distinction produced a series of absurd encounters. Butler recalled one involving a Chinese man caught photographing restricted areas near NASA. A local policeman was called. Mistaking the man for a confused tourist who claimed not to understand English, the cop conducted a cursory pat-down and dropped him off at a 7-Eleven. That's all the law allowed, Butler said. Even if a person's behavior smacked of espionage, the officer's only recourse was to provide a free ride and a Slurpee. In Tallahassee, CFIX laid out the pattern. Russo emphasized the stakes, and Glass and others carried the ball through the chambers of the Capitol. Passed in November 2024, Florida House Bill 275 closed the gap. Unauthorized entry onto critical sites, such as spaceports or defense and tech facilities, had finally become a felony to be enforced. When asked for comment, Glass, in a statement to Vanity Fair, noted that FDLE provides the technical expertise and real-world insight lawmakers need when they consider legislation that strengthens our state's security posture. He credited the leadership of DeSantis and State Representative Jennifer Kennedy in elevating domestic security in Florida. That shift became tangible on December 28th, when a Chinese national named Jiahua Song, 25, arrived at Kennedy Space Center. He purchased a ticket for a tour, then allegedly slipped away to launch a drone into Cape Canaveral's restricted airspace. NASA security detected the intrusion, intercepted Song, wearing a shirt that said Prada around the neck, and after examining his footage, realized he'd recorded critical infrastructure. Even so, they issued a trespass notice and handed him back the drone. He didn't make his New Year's Eve flight out of Orlando. Instead, the Brevard County Sheriff's Office arrested him and booked him on a state felony. Song, presumed innocent until proven guilty, is not the stuff of trench coat cliché. He's a clean-cut Ph.D. student in applied and computational math at the University of Texas at Austin. On his LinkedIn page, his listed interests read like a mash note to American innovation. NASA, SpaceX, Apple, Tesla. And as of this writing, he's back in Austin with an ankle monitor. Not a mastermind, but a marker representing to some the new face of an evolving threat. When I returned to visit Joseph and Michael Rigby Assad in December, we went to examine the threat firsthand. We began with that spooky structure Dowd had seen on A1A near the Space Force base. Assad eased his G-Wagon into the lot, empty save for an aging AMC Ambassador station wagon parked at an odd angle on the grass as if hastily abandoned. On the passenger side, two windows had been sprayed white. But inside the vehicle, we could see what looked like a home theater projector, seemingly a surveillance device, trained outward toward the property. The building resembled a nondescript medical office. Assad knocked on the front door, then knocked again. No answer. The door swung open anyway, like something out of a haunted house. The lights were on. No one was home. From the stoop, we could see that inside the premises, lining the walls, were astronaut spacesuits and scuba gear. We went around to the rear entrance. Stenciled across a white door was an illustration of an astronaut floating weightless in space. Standing sentry next to the door was a squat robotic figure that looked like R2-D2. Closer inspection suggested its helmet hit a pan-tilt zoom camera on a motorized base. As we stepped away, we caught one final detail. Outside the back door sat a large white equipment box with a thick black cable that snaked into the building. We didn't need to see more to know that the trail didn't end here. It bent inland. We headed west, toward what Dowd had suspected was the nexus of something larger. The drive passed in familiar Floridian rhythms. Pines, palmettos, mile after mile of sun-bleached normalcy. Then the scenery broke. The greenery tightened, the road narrowed, and a block-long red wall emerged from the scrub, abrupt and unmistakable. Vertical white banners bearing Taoist aphorisms and traditional Chinese landscapes adorned the facade. At the entrance, gold placards with black lettering declared, "God is owner." One sign displayed a revolver aimed outward. Its message, warning, "There is nothing here worth dying for." "This is Florida," Assad said dryly. "We don't scare that easily." We parked on the street and sent a drone into the public airspace above us, high enough to observe, yet low enough to register a possible occupant's reaction. The view didn't clarify much. "This place feels like a cult or some sort of base," Assad said, watching the feed. "Either way, someone should be able to explain it." Within minutes, a black Honda Fit slipped out from behind the obscured gate and rolled forward, nosing 25 yards in front of us, narrowing our path out. The driver didn't wave us on or tell us to move. He simply sat and watched. Assad maneuvered the drone down. When we climbed back into the car and eased forward, the Honda peeled off and disappeared. Only later, reviewing the footage, did we notice what we'd missed in the moment. White equipment boxes, nearly identical in size to the one on A1A, were positioned near the compound's two prominent entrances. Assad's analysis, this could be a receiving station for whatever was emanating from the building on A1A, or from still more buildings elsewhere. Along the space coast, there are patterns amid the palms. A woman in a bar asking suspicious questions. A house painted too uniformly to be accidental. Drones that arrive, hover, and vanish. Spooks deported instead of prosecuted. Each episode on its own was explainable. Taken together, they amounted to something more menacing. When a system demands that a hunter wait for certainty before he shoots, his prey inevitably evades capture. Christina Dowd noticed what didn't fit and refused to look away. Jonathan Cute kept probing the murky realms between tourism and treachery. Matt Butler saw accountability diminish as it moved up the chain, and the Assads, who had spent their careers prying lies from spies, recognized the lies their neighbors and some government officials liked to tell themselves, lies that foes of the U.S. had always counted on. "Americans don't like to believe this is happening here," Rigby Assad said. "Not at the beach, not near Disney, not where rockets go up and families take pictures." It was time to check in with a well-placed aerospace industry source, a former national security official who knows Florida like the back of his hand. "China is voracious and desperate to co-opt our key defense and commercial technologies," he confided. "But one of the few things they haven't stolen and replicated is our ability to launch reusable rockets. That achievement by SpaceX has given the U.S. a decisive advantage that allows us to dominate the real game right now. Who controls low Earth orbit and has the capacity to create constellations of thousands of satellites which preserve our command and control and early warning advantages?" "I don't know if this is a resourcing issue for the FBI or what, but if you were to go back and look at all the instances where Chinese nationals have been flagged flying drones over national security infrastructure across the U.S. and who were caught and released, you would be absolutely shocked. If we don't act now, when it's easier to catch those spying against our key space tech, like reusable rockets, I fear the long-term consequence is that when we're staring down the barrel of a war, our strategic advantage of controlling the heavens, or at least part of them, will be neutered." Postscript. After receiving a series of inquiries from Vanity Fair, the FBI provided the following statement. "The FBI is the lead agency for exposing, preventing, and investigating intelligence activities in the U.S. and works with many law enforcement agencies and entities to combat these threats. When appropriate, the FBI routinely shares information with public and private sector partners and publishes reports releasable to various sectors of local, state, federal, and corporate entities. These sharing efforts include the Central Florida Intelligence Exchange, CFIX. Because of federal laws, including the Privacy Act, FBI policy prohibits the routine confirmation of the existence of investigations, the release of information on investigations, and any public report on the closing of an investigation. The FBI reviews allegations of criminal conduct for their merit and, when warranted, conducts further investigation. To be clear, though, a review of allegations does not necessarily result in the opening of an investigation. Generally speaking, the FBI will work tirelessly with law enforcement and prosecutorial partners at all levels, across the state and throughout the nation, to safeguard the public. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button. Jeff Goldblum, the actor, musician, and virtuosic raconteur, is thrilled to teach the world what uxorious means and counts a certain cartoon sailor among his favorite philosophers. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Every single person and living creature on the planet is safe and well-nourished. What is your greatest fear? Any misfortune involving our kids. Also, I have recurring nightmares that involve being chased by people or being attacked by scary animals. With which historical figure do you most identify? Houdini. Which living person do you most admire? My wife. All those who contribute something of beauty. And scientist. What is your greatest extravagance? Home improvements and uxorious gifts. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Stoicism. If it hurts, say so. On what occasion do you lie? Whenever I'm acting, which I try to do truthfully, a delicious paradox. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Emily, Charlie, and River. When and where were you happiest? The first time Emily and I kissed. Which talent would you most like to have? I wouldn't mind being able to locate the pickles in the refrigerator. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I am what I am, and that's all that I am. Popeye. What do you consider your greatest achievement? I've never had a cavity. What is your most treasured possession? Our shared life force. I also like my new piano. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Solitary confinement. What is your most marked characteristic? Some people say, he's so Jeff Goldblum. What do you most value in your friends? Kindness, intelligence, humor. Who are your favorite writers? F. Scott Fitzgerald, Arthur Miller, Yuval Noah Harari, Thelonious Monk, Robert Towne, Rogers and Hart. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Detective Meyer Lansman, the main character in Michael Chabon's The Yiddish Policeman's Union. When I was a kid, I liked Zorro. Who are your heroes in real life? The playmakers for the Pittsburgh Steelers. What are your favorite names? Charlie Ocean and River Joe. What is it that you most dislike? Deliberate cruelty and itchy tags inside shirts. How would you like to die? With a clear conscience, or like the Elephant Man in the David Lynch movie? And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Jeff Goldblum. spring cleaning checklist. To borrow a line from Tolstoy, spring is the time of plans and projects. So let's kick the season off by letting go and leveling up. And here's your checklist. The Labubu collection you thought would pay for your child's college tuition. The unread copy of The Power Broker, prominently displayed on your bookshelf. Your list of New Year's resolutions. Your excessive collection of gargantuan water bottles. The X app, finally. The Finsta account you used to creep on exes and enemies. Photo dump drafts you're never going to post. All 37 of your open tabs. The tabs on your phone, too. Bottles of expired magnesium and lion's mane gathering dust in your medicine cabinet. Your plan to make matcha at home. Empty gratitude journals you never used to set intentions. Your recurring Botox appointment. All the time limits you set on your apps that you ignore. Accessories for your accessories. Charms are for bracelets, not bags. Hate following trad wives on TikTok. The 7-step nighttime skincare ritual you're too tired to do.
Thank you.
Now we'll have another Proust questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button. Ruth E. Carter, Ryan Coogler's go-to costume designer, the two-time Oscar winner who breathed life into Spike Lee's earlier masterpieces and conjured up Black Panther's signature style on taking a seminal trip to Egypt, wearing status pajamas, and telling her doctor little white lies. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Having the ability to get up in the morning with no deadlines, walk a mile just before the sun rises, yoga after that, eat a healthy breakfast with my coffee, sit down with a book, and start a new canvas. What is your greatest fear? Oversleeping on the biggest day of a film when the number one star has a new costume to establish. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Rosa Parks. Which living person do you most admire? My older sister Debbie. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I can't say no to ice cream after a meal. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Miscommunication and lack of initiative. What is your greatest extravagance? Gucci pajamas. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Virginity. On what occasion do you lie? During the questionnaire that my doctor gives me. What do you dislike most about your appearance? Honestly, nothing. I've accepted who I am, inside and out. Which living person do you most despise? Anybody who hurts a child. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My dog, Koki. When and where were you happiest? At the pyramids in Egypt on the set of Malcolm X. Which talent would you most like to have? Picking the winning lottery numbers. What is your current state of mind? Peaceful bliss. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That they would take care of themselves and each other more. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Paying off my mother's house and seeing my designs in my current traveling exhibition. If you were to die and come back as a person or a thing, what do you think it would be? A thing. I'd come back as an ocean. What is your most treasured possession? My Oscars. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Boredom. Where would you like to live? At home. I'm always on the road. What do you most value in your friends? Humor and intellect. Who are your favorite writers? Ryan Coogler and Shonda Rhimes. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? The Dora Milaje, or Adored Ones, the all-female elite warriors that serve as the bodyguards to the Black Panther and protectors of the nation of Wakanda. What are your favorite names? Zinzi, Yara. What is it that you most dislike? When people aren't truthful about their abilities, and I buy into it, how would you like to die? In my sleep. What is your motto? Trust your voice. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Ruth E. Carter. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can just tell your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. May the 4th be with you.